Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 101.
So imagine for a second what happens when the ultimate corporate fixer, the person who balances the ledgers, fires the underperformers, and essentially buries all the scandals.
Right.
What happens when that person suddenly realizes that her sprawling, powerful organization isn't just bankrupt, but is actually like fundamentally cursed?
It is basically the exact moment the entire illusion of control just completely shatters.
Yeah.
You spend your whole life building this this impenetrable fortress of wealth and status.
Yeah.
You leverage every ounce of your intelligence and willpower, and then you look down and realize the foundation is just rapidly turning to sand.
We're exploring a really pivotal, profoundly haunting snapshot of a powerful aristocratic family that is just teetering on the edge of ruin.
And I have to say, the source material we are working with today is an absolute masterclass in tension.
It really is. I mean, it blends supernatural dread, high-stakes federal political scandals, domestic betrayal, and just the kind of desperation that drives the smartest person in the room to consult a literal fortune teller.
Exactly. To move beyond just the plot. You know, we want to extract the underlying socioeconomic and psychological mechanisms at play here.
Right, getting into the gears of it.
Yeah, we are dissecting the crushing weight of systemic rot and the tragic irony of ambition. We want to understand what actually happens on a mechanical level when sheer aggressive competence is just no longer enough to hold back the tide of an imploding system.
So we need to introduce the architect of this failing empire, Wang Shifeng, though she's often referred to as Fengji in the text.
Right.
For those of you listening who study organizational structures, you can really think of her as the fiercely pragmatic chief operating officer of a massive multi-generational conglomerate.
That is a perfect analogy, honestly.
Yeah, in this historical context, she's the day-to-day manager of this gigantic elite household. So she is responsible for hundreds of servants, sprawling budgets, and really vital political optics.
She is just a fascinating case study in power. I mean, in a highly patriarchal society, she wields this immense authority through proxy, through intellect, and just sheer ruthlessness.
Yeah, she doesn't just manage the estate, she dominates it.
She does. She's feared, she's respected, and she's highly effective at extracting short-term value. But as we dissect this narrative, we're going to see the specific vulnerabilities of her management style.
We're basically going to watch the absolute strongest link in the chain just snap under the pressure of a fundamentally toxic environment.
Precisely. And the breakdown starts in a way you really wouldn't expect.
No, not at all. Not in a boardroom, not over a ledger, but out in a garden, the Grandview Garden, specifically at night.
The sensory details in the source text here are just brilliant at establishing atmosphere.
They really are. So Fengji is taking this nighttime walk, and the text describes the moonlight as shining so brightly it looks like water pooling on the ground.
Which is such a striking image.
It is. And on paper, that sounds, you know, serene, but the actual vibe is incredibly unsettling.
Well, because serenity in a space like the Grandview Garden is inherently unnatural.
Hmm.
To understand the psychological weight of this scene, you really have to understand what this garden represents.
Right. It's not just a backyard.
Far from it. It is a highly manicured, heavily engineered monument to the family's wealth. During the day, it is bustling with hundreds of servants, gardeners, and maids. It's this machine of constant noise and human activity.
So it's never quiet.
Never. So when you strip away that comforting, validating noise of human industry and you plunge it into the silence of an unelectrified ancient night, the artificiality of the space just becomes terrifying.
The watery moonlight kind of exposes her total isolation.
Exactly. It strips away her armor.
And the environment immediately responds to that vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, this violent whistling wind blows through the trees. It creates this sharp rushing sound through the leaves that actually startles the sleeping crows, sending them scattering into the dark.
It's so visceral.
It is. And Fengji, who is famously unflappable, suddenly feels this deep, penetrating chill. She actually sends her maid away to fetch a silver fox vest because she's uncharacteristically freezing.
Which is a crucial tactical error brought on by physical discomfort.
Oh, absolutely.
By sending the maid away, she physically isolates herself, leaving her entirely vulnerable to whatever the night has to offer.
And what it offers is terrifying. She's walking alone, and the text says she hears heavy breathing right behind her.
Oh, it's so creepy.
A distinct sniffing sound. Her hair literally stands on end, and when she turns around, she doesn't see a person. She sees this massive black furred animal.
Yeah.
The source describes it as having eyes glowing like lamps and a tail sweeping like a broom. It's an enormous black dog. It sniffs her, bounds up a dirt mound, and just looks back at her.
Let's unpack the cultural mechanics of that specific imagery, though.
Yeah, please do, because it feels significant.
It is. In historical folklore and localized belief systems, a large black dog is rarely just a stray animal. It is heavily associated with the underworld.
So it's an omen.
Yes, it operates as a threshold guardian. It's an omen that the boundary between the living and the dead, or the physical and the spiritual, has thinned. But even if we strip away the supernatural element for a second, just consider the physical reality here. Encountering a massive feral predator inside your highly walled, heavily guarded private estate completely destroys the illusion of security.
Right, because her empire's borders have technically been breached.
Exactly. It totally destabilizes her.
And you see that physical destabilization instantly. Her heart is racing, she's hurrying away, and then this is the ultimate sign of her losing control. She trips over a rock.
Yeah, the physical faltering.
This woman who dictates the movements of hundreds of people loses her own physical coordination. She falls, she is sweating profusely, like practically raining sweat, and when she looks up, she sees a ghost.
A literal apparition.
Yeah, one that she eventually recognizes as Qin Shi, a deceased relative from the family.
And Qin Shi was the first wife of Jia Rong. Her appearance here is not arbitrary at all. Mm. She represents a very specific ideology regarding wealth and survival that Feng Ji historically rejected.
Right, because the ghost doesn't just scare her, she actually lectures her.
She does.
The apparition delivers this chilling rebuke, reminding Feng Ji of advice given years ago to build an, quote, eternal foundation.
Yes.
And the ghost explicitly states that because Feng Ji was entirely focused on immediate wealth, personal glory, and short-term hoarding, this eternal foundation has been cast into the Eastern Ocean. It is lost. And then Feng Ji wakes from this, drenched in sweat.
It's a terrifying sequence.
It is. And if we look at this from a modern clinical perspective, I really have to wonder, is this text actually giving us a ghost story? Or is this an early brilliant depiction of executive burnout?
Oh, that's an interesting way to frame it.
Because if you've ever worked an 80-hour week keeping a failing project afloat, lying to investors and running on fumes, your subconscious will absolutely project your deepest anxieties. The sweating, the tripping, the racing heart, it reads exactly like a massive panic attack manifesting as a hallucination.
You know, you could certainly view it through a modern psychological lens, and the somatic symptoms of a panic attack are undeniably present.
Yeah.
But to reduce it merely to corporate burnout kind of strips away the severe existential stakes of the era's worldview.
Mm.
In this cultural framework, ancestors and deceased relatives aren't just memories.
Right.
They are literal, active stakeholders in the family enterprise.
So they hold equity.
Precisely. They rely on the living to maintain the sacrifices and the family honor, and the living rely on them for spiritual protection. So when the ghost of Qin Shi critiques Feng Ji, it is a spiritual audit.
A spiritual audit. I like that.
Let's examine the specific phrase she uses, though. Eternal foundation. What does that actually mean in an aristocratic agrarian economy?
I mean, I'm guessing it's not just a fat savings account.
Far from it. Liquid wealth like gold, silver, cash is highly volatile. It can be confiscated by the emperor in a single day.
Oh, true.
An eternal foundation requires establishing assets that survive political disfavor. It means buying ancestral land trusts that are legally protected from state seizure.
Okay, so long-term physical assets.
Yes. It also means establishing clan schools so the next generation can pass the imperial exams and regain political power if the current generation falls. It is a deeply defensive, multi-generational strategy.
But Feng Ji's strategy is entirely offensive.
Entirely.
She operates on high-risk, high-reward power plays. She extracts maximum value from the present moment. Like, she loans money at exorbitant interest rates, she hoards cash, she manipulates the local magistrates for quick wins.
Exactly. So the ghost represents the return of the repressed long-term view. Feng Ji's physical collapse in the garden proves that her psychological armor is shattered.
Because she knows the ghost is right.
Yes. Her conscious mind can no longer suppress the terrifying reality that her aggressive short-term management has basically doomed the family's long-term survival. And the scariest part, she cannot bribe or intimidate a ghost.
That profound nighttime vulnerability is chilling. But it makes you wonder, can she just shake it off in the morning? Like, does the daylight offer a reset?
You would hope so.
But unfortunately, the daylight reality is actually even more terrifying than the ghost because the external system is actively imploding. We transition from Fengji's internal terror to the cold, harsh political reality facing her husband, Jia Lian.
Right. And that transition from the spiritual to the bureaucratic is totally jarring by design. The sun rises, but the nightmare merely shifts from the metaphysical to the federal.
Yeah, we find Jia Lian waking up long before dawn. He is frantically trying to manage the external threats to the family. He has scheduled a meeting with the powerful eunuch named Qu Xian to try and pull some political strings and cover up family scandals.
And before we move past that, we really need to understand the structural role of eunuchs in this political system. Because why is Jia Lian, a wealthy aristocrat, desperately trying to meet a eunuch before the sun comes up?
Yeah, what is the power dynamic there?
Well, in the imperial system, eunuchs were ostensibly servants of the inner palace. But because of their physical proximity to the emperor, they operated as this massive, informal shadow bureaucracy.
So they completely bypassed the official channels.
Entirely. The formal government, the magistrates, the ministers, they operated on complex legal codes, but eunuchs operated on access and favors.
So it's all backroom deals.
Exactly. If you needed a federal investigation squashed or a governor reassigned, you didn't go to court. You bribed the eunuch who whispered in the emperor's ear while serving his tea.
Wow.
So Jia Lian's reliance on Qu Xian demonstrates that the family can no longer survive on their own merit or formal legal standing. They are relying entirely on the black market of political influence.
And he desperately needs that influence because before he leaves for this meeting, he reads the morning court reports.
Oh, this part is brutal.
These are the official government briefs circulating among the elite. And what he reads is devastating. Let's break down the two specific scandals because they highlight exactly how systemic rot operates.
Okay, let's go through them.
So the first scandal, the governor of Yunnan, a man named Wang Zong, has apprehended 18 smugglers at the border. But they aren't smuggling contraband silk or untaxed tea. They are smuggling illegal firearms and gunpowder out of the territory.
Which is a massive escalation.
It is. And the ringleader of this operation, Bao Yin, explicitly claims to be the servant of the Jia family's relative, Jia Hua.
We have to pause and look at the legal mechanics of this crime. Smuggling firearms is not a standard white-collar crime. It is a direct existential threat to the state's monopoly on violence.
Right. It's not just tax evasion.
No. In the Ming and Qing legal codes, supplying weapons across borders is tantamount to treason. And the justice system of this era heavily utilized collective punishment.
Meaning the entire family goes down?
Yes. The concept of the nine familial extermination.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. If a relative commits treason, the state doesn't just execute the individual. They execute the parents, the grandparents, the siblings, the children, and the cousins.
So when Jia Lian reads that a family relative is implicated in a massive arms smuggling ring, he isn't just worried about bad PR. He is looking at the very real possibility of the entire Jia clan being rounded up and executed.
Exactly. The stakes could literally not be higher.
And it doesn't stop there, because he reads a second scandal. The governor of Suzhou reports a triple homicide. A man attempted a sexual assault against a chaste widow, leading to the brutal deaths of three people in her household. And the murderer, Shi Fu, openly claims to be a servant of another family relative, Jia Fan.
It's just relentless.
So Jia Lian is staring at documents tying his family's name to treasonous arms dealing and horrific domestic murder.
Which is a staggering amount of liability.
It is. And if you are listening to this and trying to wrap your head around how this happens, think of it like a dark, twisted version of corporate franchising.
I love this analogy. Go ahead.
The Jia family name is the parent brand. They have immense social and political capital, but they have essentially franchised that name out to dozens of distant relatives, hangers-on, and servants.
The concept of borrowed power is the most toxic element of an unchecked aristocratic hierarchy.
Right, because these peripheral figures, these rogue franchisees, are using the parent company's trademark to commit horrific crimes, knowing that local police won't arrest someone wearing the Jia uniform.
They assume they have immunity.
Exactly. They are smuggling guns and murdering people because they assume the parent company, Jia Lian and Fengji, will use their political fixers to protect the brand.
And your franchising analogy highlights the ultimate trap here. The parent company, Jia Lian, is legally and socially responsible for the actions of these distant servants, but he has absolutely zero operational control over them.
He can't manage what they're doing day to day.
He is thousands of miles away from Yunnan and Suzhou. The rot isn't just at the top. The entire network is infected. The people at the bottom act with impunity, assuming the top will shield them, while the people at the top are collapsing under the weight of the liability.
Which triggers this incredible psychological reaction. Jilian reads these reports, panics, rushes out, and completely misses his narrow window to meet the eunuch.
He's too late.
The eunuch has already gone to the inner palace. The shadow bureaucracy is closed for the day. So Jilian returns home entirely impotent, unable to stop these federal investigations closing in on him.
Just completely defeated.
And then he walks into his private quarters and finds the maid still sleeping. They weren't expecting him back so early. He demands tea. A flustered maid brings him a cup that was warmed over, not freshly brewed.
And this is where it snaps.
Yeah, Jilian takes this teacup and violently, aggressively smashes it to pieces on the floor, terrifying the staff.
The smashed teacup is a masterclass in the psychology of loss control. It perfectly illustrates the dynamic between macro-impotence and micro-tyranny.
Macro-impotence and micro-tyranny. Expand on that, because that is a powerful concept.
Well, Jilian is facing the annihilation of his family line. He has absolutely no leverage over the governor of Yunnan. He cannot control the eunuch who ignored him.
Right.
On a macro level, the universe is crushing him, and he is totally powerless. The human ego simply cannot sustain that level of total impotence. So what does he do? He aggressively asserts absolute dominance over the only sphere he can still control, the micro details of his domestic life.
He can't stop a treason trial, but he can terrorize a teenager for giving him lukewarm tea.
Exactly. The violence against the teacup isn't about the tea. It is a desperate, pathetic performance of authority. It is the ultimate manifestation of a manager who realizes his title is utterly meaningless outside his own living room.
And when you take a man who is experiencing that level of displaced rage and you put him in a room with his wife, Fenji, who, as we know, is privately deteriorating from her own spiritual and physical crises, the explosion is inevitable.
It's a powder keg.
The macro political scandals outside the walls instantly bleed into the micro corruption of their own marriage.
Because when a system begins to collapse, the internal cohesion dissolves immediately. The external pressure forces every member of the system to frantically search for a scapegoat.
So the teacup incident spirals into this vicious shouting argument between the husband and wife, and Jilian drops a massive bombshell.
He really does.
He finally reveals why he's been running himself ragged, missing sleep, and trying to bribe eunuchs in the dark. He is trying to fix a massive financial catastrophe caused by Fengji's own brother, Wang Ren.
To understand the gravity of this, we really need to understand the financial mechanics of aristocratic debt.
Yeah, how does this work?
So the brother scheme involves a deceased uncle, Wang Zisheng, who left behind a massive government deficit.
Okay.
In the imperial system, officials were often responsible for local tax quotas or state funds. If they embezzled those funds or simply failed to collect them, the debt didn't just vanish when they died. The government demanded restitution from the surviving family.
It's inherited institutional debt.
Exactly.
And the government is coming to collect. So to raise the cash to pay off this massive deficit, Fengji's brother, Wang Ren, concocts a plan that is so shameless it honestly borders on comedy.
It's absurd.
He decides to throw an incredibly lavish, highly publicized, but entirely fake birthday party for a different living uncle.
Yes. He is explicitly exploiting the cultural mechanics of Guanxi, which is relationship building through obligatory gift giving.
Right. He sends out invitations to all their wealthy friends, political allies, and subordinates. And in this society, you cannot attend a senior relative's birthday empty-handed.
No, it would be a massive insult.
You must bring expensive gifts and cash. So Wang Ren is essentially running an aristocratic Ponzi scheme, using the sacred cultural duty of family celebration as a front to extort cash from his social network to secretly pay off a dead man's embezzled debts.
It is a stunning perversion of Confucian duty.
It really is.
He is weaponizing the appearance of family loyalty to commit large-scale financial fraud. And Jilian is furious because the grift is sloppy. Everyone knows what Wang Ren is doing. And Jilian is the one forced to use his own political capital to manage the fallout and keep the authorities from looking too closely at the Wang family's finances.
And during this argument, Jilian delivers a linguistic takedown that is just lethal.
Oh, the pun. It's so good.
He utilizes a bitter pun regarding the brother's name. In Chinese, the brother's name is Wang Ren. But Jilian verbally redefines the characters. He tells Feng Zhi that her brother isn't representing the Wang of their noble family name. He is the Wang that means to forget.
Right.
And he isn't the Ren of a given name. He is the Ren that stands for the absolute core of Confucian philosophy. Benevolence, righteousness, propriety, wisdom, and trust.
The character Ren is the bedrock of societal morality in their world. It implies deep empathy, humaneness, and the ethical obligations we owe to one another.
So when Jialinan calls him forgetful of benevolence,
he is performing a total social execution. He is stating that her brother, and by extension her family line, is utterly morally bankrupt. They have forgotten the very philosophical principles that justify their elite status. They are parasites.
Now, if you know anything about Feng Ji's character, this is the moment you expect her to go absolutely nuclear.
Oh, normally she would destroy him.
Right. She is the fiercest debater in the family. She dominates Jialinan. Usually, if he insulted her family, she would unleash a torrent of wit, volume, and threats to crush him. But what happens here is shocking.
It is.
She doesn't yell. She doesn't fight back. She breaks down and cries. She actually submits.
And her silence is the most significant action she takes. To understand why she folds, we have to examine how power operates for a wife in a deeply patrilineal society.
Walk us through that mechanism. Why does a powerful CEO type completely surrender here?
Because a woman's authority in her husband's household is never entirely her own. It is heavily tethered to the political and financial strength of her maiden family.
Ah, I see.
The Wang family is Feng Ji's bedrock.
Uh-huh.
They are her implicit threat. If Jialinan mistreats her, the Lums can intervene.
Mm-hmm.
But Jialinan has just empirically proven that the Wangs are not a shield. They are a massive, embarrassing liability.
Her foundation is literally gone.
Exactly. When your own brother is running a sloppy extortion racket, you lose all moral and political high ground.
Yeah.
She realizes she cannot defend the indefensible. Her usual strategy of overwhelming force fails because she suddenly sees that she is isolated. If the Jia family decides to cast her out, her maiden family is too corrupt and chaotic to protect her. She is a hostage to her brother's incompetence.
And that sudden total isolation immediately bleeds into the most visceral segment of the story. We've seen her political armor fail. We've seen her familial backing collapse. And now we see the raw, terrifying reality of what happens to the most vulnerable members of an ecosystem when the apex predator loses her teeth.
It happens so fast.
It does. The argument ends. Jialinan storms out. Feng Zhi is physically ill and emotionally destroyed. Her trusted maid, Ping Er, is massaging her, trying to give her a few moments of peace to physically recover.
Right.
But this quiet intimacy is violently interrupted by the sound of Feng Ji's daughter, Da Jier, crying in the adjacent room.
And what unfolds next is just a brilliant demonstration of how quickly power dynamics shift within the servant hierarchy.
Da Jier is being watched by her wet nurse, an older woman named Li Ma. Li Ma is sleeping nearby and is intensely annoyed at being woken up by the crying. So instead of soothing the child of her incredibly powerful employer, Li Ma lashes out.
Yes.
She physically pinches the baby to make her stop crying, and she mutters a dark curse, calling the Da Jier a short-lived ghost who should be lying dead.
We need to analyze the role of the wet nurse to grasp how shocking this actually is. A wet nurse in an aristocratic household is not merely a babysitter.
No, it's a completely different level of status.
She provides the literal lifeblood to the heir. Because of this intimate biological bond, wet nurses often accrued immense informal power. They were heavily respected, sometimes feared, and closely protected by the matriarchs.
So why on earth would a servant risk her life by physically abusing the child of the most ruthless woman in the compound?
Because Li Ma is reading the political weather. Servants in this environment are incredibly astute observers of power. Li Ma knows about the federal scandals. She heard the explosive fight between Jialinan and Feng Zhi. She can see that Feng Zhi is physically deteriorating.
She smells blood in the water.
Precisely. The pinch is not just a reflex of annoyance. It is a calculated test of the boundaries. She is instinctively reacting to the fact that the matriarch's protective aura has vanished.
It's the ultimate canary in the coal mine. If the CEO cannot even protect her own infant from being assaulted by an employee in the literal next room, the hierarchy is a complete illusion. The authority is just gone.
It proves that power in this system is only as strong as your immediate capacity for violence and retribution. The moment you show weakness, the subordinates turn on the most vulnerable link of the child.
And Feng Zhi hears the baby cry. She hears the curse. But she doesn't storm into the room. She doesn't order the nurse beaten or fired, which is what she would have done a year ago without blinking.
No, she doesn't do any of that.
Instead, she falls into a devastating, tragic fatalism. She turns to her maid, Pinger and delivers this haunting monologue. She says, "I am already 25 years old." She reflects on her life. She's eaten the finest foods, worn the best silks, wielded massive power, and ruthlessly crushed her enemies.
She's had everything.
She has accumulated everything the material world has to offer. But in this moment of profound despair, she identifies the one critical asset she lacks. She says she is lacking in longevity. She knows physically and spiritually that she is dying.
This is the ultimate collapse of the Eternal Foundation.
Yeah.
All her frantic hoarding, her manipulation, her relentless management, it was all designed to secure a future. But wealth cannot buy biological time.
She looks at her reality and says, "If I die, I don't know what will happen to this little creature." She's looking at Dodgier and realizing that her legacy isn't a powerful empire.
Right.
It's a defenseless child surrounded by wolves.
And Pinger, the maid, is moved to tears by this. Not just out of sympathy, but because Pinger understands the mechanics of the house.
She knows what's coming.
She knows Feng Ji is entirely correct. Without Feng Ji's ruthless protection, the other branches of the family, the vicious servants, the corrupt uncles, they will devour the child.
It forces a profound reevaluation of her entire life's philosophy. The aggressive extraction of wealth alienated everyone who might have genuinely cared for her daughter.
Exactly. By making herself the sole pillar of power, she guaranteed that when she falls, the roof crushes her child.
It is so incredibly heavy, and honestly, we need a shift in perspective here. But as we move from Feng Ji's quarters to the rooms of the younger generation, we realize that the rot has infected them too, just in a fundamentally different way.
Right.
We transition to Bao Yu, the young, pampered, highly sensitive male heir of the family.
And if the older generation is paralyzed by the political and financial consequences of their actions, the younger generation is paralyzed by their inability to process emotional trauma.
We find Bayou lounging in his room with his new wife, Bao Chai. It seems like a peaceful domestic morning. They are bantering about his wardrobe for the day, and the conversation centers on a very specific garment, a magnificent peacock feather cape that was gifted to him by his grandmother.
We really should detail the material culture of this cape.
Uh-huh.
A peacock feather cape in this era isn't just a fancy coat. It is a masterpiece of artisanal labor. Woven with genuine peacock down and gold thread, it is a singular, irreplaceable artifact.
Yet Bao Yu adamantly refuses to wear it. And the reason he refuses reveals a deep, unprocessed trauma.
Yes.
Feng Ji drops by to visit, and the head maid, Zhirin, has to explain the history of the cape to her. Zhirin explains that some time ago, Bao Yu accidentally burned a hole in this priceless garment.
A total disaster.
None of the professional tailors in the city dared to touch it because the weaving technique was so complex. But one of Bao Yu's maids, Ting Wen, possessed the necessary skill.
And her repair of the cape was an act of extreme, almost fatal devotion.
Right. Ting Wen was deathly ill at the time. She was practically bedridden. But because she loved Bayou and wanted to protect him from his grandmother's wrath, she propped herself up in bed and spent a single agonizing night repairing the cape stitch by excruciating stitch.
Literally draining the absolute last reserves of her life force.
It is a profound manifestation of emotional and physical labor. She literally wove her remaining life into the fabric.
She did.
But the tragedy doesn't end there. Shortly after, King Wen dies. And she didn't just succumb to the illness. Her death was accelerated by the vicious internal politics of the house.
The rumor mill.
Yeah, the gossip of jealous servants convinced the madam of the house that King Wen was seducing Bayou. As a result, this sick, devoted girl was driven out and essentially hounded to death.
Which is horrific.
Because of this, Bayou is utterly traumatized. He refuses to wear the cape. He demands it be locked away in a trunk forever as a shrine to her memory. For him, wearing it would be a sacrilege.
Bayou possesses a worldview that is deeply antithetical to the aristocratic machine. For him, human beings are profoundly unique, and the objects they interact with become sanctified by their emotional labor.
He fully feels it.
He feels the crushing weight of King Wen's humanity and the guilt of his family's complicity in her death. His refusal to wear the cape is an act of mourning, but is also a paralyzing inability to move forward.
But here is where the narrative gives us severe whiplash.
Oh, Feng Ji's response.
Yes. Feng Ji is listening to this tragic backstory. And instead of offering empathy, she offers a logistical solution.
A terrifyingly pragmatic solution.
She tells Bayou, listen, there is a kitchen maid named Wur who happens to look exactly like King Wen, a literal doppelganger. Why don't I just transfer Wur to your room to serve you? Problem solved.
Wow.
I had to stop and reread this mechanism. Bayou is drowning in grief over the systemic murder of his closest friend, and the COO's solution is to cast a lookalike actor to fill the visual void. It is a staggering display of emotional detachment.
It perfectly illuminates Feng Ji's philosophy of human capital, though. She operates entirely on the concept of fungibility.
Fungibility? Explain how she implies that to human beings.
Well, in economics, fungibility means that units of a good are completely interchangeable. A dollar bill is fungible with another dollar bill. To Feng Ji, servants are entirely fungible commodities.
So they aren't people to her.
They are not individuals with souls or intrinsic value. They are functional parts in her machine. If a gear named King Wen breaks and is discarded, you do not mourn the gear. You simply go to the inventory, find a gear with the exact same dimensions, a girl named War, and slot her into the machine.
Human resources as literal disposable resources.
Exactly. Her solution completely ignores the emotional sanctification that Bayou values. It highlights the terrifying disconnect the elite managerial class has from the humanity of their labor force. To Feng Ji, grief is just an inefficiency that can be solved with a quick staffing swap.
But the profound irony here is that Feng Ji's logistical managerial worldview is completely failing her in her own life.
It's crumbling.
She can try to manage Bayou's grief like a staffing issue, but she cannot manage the federal indictments, her brother's corruption, or her own failing body. And that brings us to the final phase of her collapse.
Right.
When sheer competence, logistics, and manipulation fail, what does the ultimate pragmatist do? She turns to the absurd.
Because when logic provides no escape, the human mind will eagerly embrace magic.
We see a nun named Dallas visit the compound, and she brings with her the story of the Sanhwa Bodhisattva. The origin story of this deity is a wild, almost comical amalgamation of tropes.
It really is bizarre.
The nun claims this bodhisattva was born with horns on his head and four eyes. He was abandoned in a snowbank, rescued and raised in a cave by an ancient monkey, and grew up to speak pure Zen philosophy until literal flowers rained down from the heavens. After 1,000 years, he ascended.
We have to analyze why this specific bizarre story is included in the text.
Yeah, why is it there?
It represents the clash between orthodox, philosophical high religion, and localized, syncretic folk religion. Orthodox Buddhism doesn't feature monkey parents or four-eyed babies.
Right, that sounds a bit off.
This story is an aggressive pastiche of folk superstitions. It's designed to sound ancient and powerful to an uneducated or desperate audience.
And historically, Feng Ji would have mocked this. She is a cynical, cutthroat realist. She doesn't believe in karma. She believes in cash and leverage.
Yes, she would have laughed it out of the room.
But because she is terrified by the ghost, physically deteriorating and watching her political power evaporate, she makes an entirely uncharacteristic decision. She decides to go to the temple to draw a fortune stick to divine her future.
It is the ultimate capitulation. The woman who controlled the fate of hundreds is now surrendering her own agency to a randomized bamboo stick at a shrine dedicated to a monkey-raised god. It is the absolute nadir of her confidence.
It's like watching a ruthless, data-driven hedge fund manager consulting a tarot card reader on the sidewalk because the SEC is raiding their office.
Yeah.
The desperation is just palpable.
That's exactly what it is.
So she goes to the temple and she draws stick number 33. The primary fortune reads, Wang Zifeng returns home in silken robes.
Returns home in silken robes.
Okay.
In common optimistic parlance, this translates to returning in glory.
And the family immediately seizes on this optimistic reading. They are desperate for good news. They blindly interpret returning in silk to mean that Feng Ji's disgraced father is going to receive a massive government promotion, or that the family's legal troubles will vanish and they will return to their ancestral hometown as conquering heroes.
They view it as a divine get out of jail free card.
But the illusion of salvation is always the final trap.
Always. The fortune stick includes a full poem, and it requires careful literary analysis. It is not a blessing, it is a eulogy.
Let's read the full poem. 20 years away, returning in silk, bees making honey, who is the bitter toil for? Pedestrian arrives, news delayed, lawsuit settles, marriage rediscussed. Now, Baoyu's wife, Bao Chai, is present when this is read. She is highly educated, observant, and politically astute. The source material explicitly notes her silent skepticism. She doesn't voice her concerns, but she knows the family is misreading the text.
Bao Chai understands the classical literary mechanics at play here. Let's start with the phrase, returning home in silken robes.
Right. What does that actually mean?
In classical Chinese euphemism, returning home does not always mean taking a vacation to your hometown. It frequently operates as a euphemism for returning to one's ultimate home, the grave. Mm-hmm. It means death.
Oh, wow. So the silken robes?
The silken robes are burial shrouds.
That completely changes it.
Alternatively, returning home can signify a divorced, disgraced woman being exiled back to her maiden family in shame. Either way, it is a prophecy of removal, not victory. Bao Tai sees that the fortune is predicting Fengji's tragic end, disguised just enough to let the gullible find false hope.
That reframes the entire poem, and it makes the next line absolutely devastating. Bees making honey, who is the bitter toil for?
That single line is the thesis statement of Fengji's entire existence.
She is the worker bee.
She is the apex worker bee. She has exhausted her physical health. She has committed profound moral sins. She has manipulated, extorted, and destroyed people, all to build this massive reserve of wealth and stability. She made the honey.
But who is the bitter toil for? Because she isn't going to get to eat it.
Exactly. The system she sacrificed her soul to protect is going to collapse, or is going to cast her aside when she's no longer useful. Her maiden family is corrupt. Her husband hates her. The servants are waiting for her to die so they can prey on her child. She toiled bitterly to amass an empire that will provide her no shelter in her final moments.
It is a stunning realization. The ultimate manager, the woman who viewed human beings as fungible resources, realizes that she herself was just a resource to be extracted by the system.
A total reversal.
If we pull all of these threads together, the overarching mechanics point to a universal, terrifying reality. We are looking at the exact moment an individual realizes that their sheer intelligence, willpower, and hustle are fundamentally useless against the gravity of systemic collapse.
Whether that collapse is driven by macro forces like federal investigations and collective punishment, or micro forces like a servant turning on your child, or even just the unavoidable reality of your own failing body, the conclusion is identical.
The fortress was built on sand.
The illusion of control shatters, leaving behind nothing but profound vulnerability.
That's a sobering breakdown.